Hello and welcome to The Moment That Made Me, this time.
I had no idea that the military had doctors. One day you're Neil Greenberg and the next day you're Surgeon Sub-Lieutenant Greenberg.
How a cruise ship doctor unknowingly inspired a world-leading career in military mental health and many adventures at sea.
And I said, gosh, sir, you know, these waves are pretty big. And he went, oh, yes, doctor, you know, we ended up losing our bow dome in the Bermuda Triangle. I was involved in the weapons engineering department. I was officer of the day at sea. Hopefully I'm making a little bit of difference being a lot of places.
The moment that made Professor Neil Greenberg came from a radio programme in December 1988.
So back in 1988, I was a medical student at Southampton University. No one in my family was a doctor. My mother was a hairdresser. My father was an accountant. And there was no one in my family who had ever been either in medicine or in the military. And I had no idea at that time that the military had doctors, because it was not something that had come on my radar, so to speak. I was sitting at home on the Christmas holidays. I think it was before Christmas. And I was just listening to the radio whilst I was doing something, which was probably not something I did too often, but yeah, I did on that occasion. And on the radio comes the doctor, who was then the doctor on the QE2. So, you know, the cruise liner, which, because I was going to become a doctor, I thought that sounds interesting. So I listened to his stories, and he was sort of regaling about how he had a great time as being the ship's doctor. And then he'd said he'd been in the Royal Navy, which had got him interested in being a doctor on board ships. And I thought, gosh, I never even knew the military had doctor. But one of my friends at university at the time, his brother was in the Navy. I knew that. And when I went back after Christmas, my friend's name was Chris. I said to Chris, did you know the Navy has doctors? You know, your brother's in the Navy. And Chris said, oh, yes, I do. And what's more, I'm going up to London in a couple of weeks' time to go and speak about joining the Navy myself. I said, my gosh, that's interesting. And I said, do you think I can come? So we phoned up the person who was the appointer, so then the recruiter, who was a surgeon captain doctor himself, and the military sent me a rail warrant, which is all very nice. It was a free train ticket, and so I went with Chris up to London to have an informal chat, and that kind of started off my interest and then eventually my career in the Navy.
Just to go back and talk a little bit more about hearing that person speaking on the radio, what was it that struck you? What was it about that, what that person was saying and how they were saying it that made an impression on you?
Well, I think, just to give you a little bit of background, so when I didn't really know anything about medicine other than I wanted to be a doctor. And what I had learned, I think, in the first year at medical school, as well as learning the sort of basic biology, was that once you become a doctor, you enter sort of a chain of experiences where you are a junior doctor, you're then part of a team. And there's quite a long road into becoming a consultant. And it all seemed kind of quite structured, which is fine. I had no problems with that. But I guess in my life, I always wanted to perhaps do something which is a bit exciting and a bit different. And so when I heard this doctor on the radio speak about the fact that they've been in the Navy and they said they've been to some foreign places and had some interesting diseases to treat, and then they ended up, you know, working for this cruise company on a big cruise liner, I thought that sounds like a pathway which is different to the one that I thought I was going to have to do. And so that's what led me to think, well, you know, if this person on the radio has done it, maybe I could do it too. So I think it was that the interest was there into not just do a standard process of becoming a doctor. And this seemed to potentially provide a way that I could do that.
And so you got your free train ticket, you signed up. Tell me about your first postings and the impression they made.
Yeah, so you sign up at medical school. So I think I was entering my third year out of five. So one day you're Neil Greenberg and the next day you're Surgeon Sub-Lieutenant Greenberg. But I knew no more about the military than I did the day before, really. But then you got I think it was a 2-day or maybe it was a 3-day sort of stint in Portsmouth, which isn't very far from Southampton where I was studying. And they sort of showed you how to put your uniform on and took you about a few ships. But you didn't really know very much. And so then when I finally finished my medical degree, and then my second junior doctor job was in Haslar Hospital, which was then the Royal Navy Hospital in Haslar. And so that was my first proper introduction to sort of Navy life, where I was wearing my uniform, seeing military patients and, you know, living in the wardroom and all those sorts of things. And so I think when I finally became a fully qualified doctor after doing the junior jobs, I knew a bit about sick and unwell naval patients, but I didn't know a lot about, you know, how the Navy worked. After finishing Dartmouth and my basic training there, my first job, actually, interestingly, was a very brief one for 2 weeks at HMS Collingwood. And I was the deputy principal medical officer, which is basically the junior of the two doctors. And what was fascinating there is the doctor who was the senior doctor, he was a surgeon commander, he had been in the Falklands on one of the ships. I think it was Sheffield that sunk. And so I didn't know this chap at all. I turned up and, you know, he's a senior officer. I said, "Hello, sir." He said, "Come into my office." "Okay, sir. Yeah, well, whatever you want." And it's the first day I met him. He sat me down and showed me picture books of what he'd experienced during the Falklands War. I mean, looking back now as a psychiatrist who's really interested in trauma, this was many years after the war. I think he was clearly affected by it. And so I listened and watched and spoke to him, went away thinking, gosh, you know, he's, well, it was a funny thing to do straight away as the first thing when a junior doctor joins your department. Anyway, I did that for 2 weeks. And then I was very lucky. My first ship was HMS Monmouth, which was a Type 23 frigate. It was a relatively new ship. And the trip that I went on that, I did a global deployment. So I went around the world, left in February 1995, came back in November. We did 30 port stops around the world. I went through the Suez Canal and the Panama Canal, ended up going on pit-to-pit Cairn Island, which is a completely remote British dependency in the Pacific. It was fantastic. I won't lie, in the sense that a few months into it, I remember thinking, gosh, I'm a long way from home and everything seems all very far away. But at the same time, I was with a great bunch of people and I went to some really interesting places. And I guess as the doctor, you have a funny role on board in the sense that everyone wants to be nice to you because you're going to end up giving them medication, looking after them. But at the same time, if you don't integrate into the ship's company, you can kind of feel that you're sort of separate and apart because you only have one person to manage, who was a great chap, who was a leading medical assistant, Simon Martin. He was fantastic. And one of the little stories I'll tell you there is, as we're going across the Atlantic, the weather was really, really bad. Now, of course, I haven't been to sea on a ship before, so what do I know? And I'm up on the bridge with the captain, who's in his captain's chair, and these waves are coming over the ship at the front. And I say, "Gosh, sir, you know, these waves are pretty big." And he went, "Oh, yes, doctor, you know, inexperienced doctor, yes, yes, yes." And then a huge wave came over, and I remember him going, "Actually, you're quite right, they are pretty big." And we ended up losing our bow dome in the Bermuda Triangle somewhere. We took quite a lot of damage. We had to go into port for about a week in order to have repairs made. What I remember as we were going across the Atlantic, the weather was really, really bad, as I said. And the medical store on the ship was right at the forecastle, right at the front of the ship, the pointy bit. And it flooded. So the medical store flooded and there was water all in our disaster. We had all these disaster stores, which included things such as sanitary products for women, although it was an all-male ship, it was for disasters, but also plaster of Paris and, you know, pills. And basically all the, and they were in, who designed these things? They were in cardboard boxes. And so, they're basically all sort of mushed together. And we had plaster of Paris and sanitary products with water. And it was all a complete mess. And I didn't get massively seasick, but I did get a bit seasick. I remember my medical assistant going, "Sir, leave this with me. You go back to your cabin." And I remember thinking, "You are a really good egg."
you certainly got the adventure you were seeking, didn't you? I mean, how much doctoring did you get to do?
Well, a ship's company is generally pretty young. Yeah, most of them are under 40. There aren't really any over 50. I did lots of general doctoring. I did some minor surgery, which I quite liked at the time. I saw people who had minor sickness, but thankfully we didn't have on that trip anyone who was seriously ill. I sent a few people home, you know, who busted knees and the like. So I think I did a good sort of general practice type approach was 170 people. So I think the medicine was reasonable, but there was nothing that was particularly taxing.
And what about your military skills? How did you manage to keep them sharp alongside being a doctor?
Well, there's loads of opportunities for training on board, and so I learned an awful lot about the ship. You know, so I wasn't just in my sick bay and in my cabin. I was involved in the weapons engineering department. I was officer of the day at sea. I was go out with the air crew regularly, so we'd go out and fly places to pick up mail, but also to do a few interesting things. So I think it took a few months, but I really sort of integrated into the ship's company. And I think at the end, I wasn't just the doctor. I was doing lots of useful things because there's loads of jobs to do on board ship, really. My general view is at that point, I was interested in being a psychiatrist, and I managed to convince the appointers that what I wanted to do was not just stay on ships, but I wanted to see the Navy. So my next job after that ship was to go in a nuclear submarine. So I was the doctor in HMS Spartan, which was a hunter killer nuclear submarine, and we went down again through the Suez Canal into the Indian Ocean to do some stuff that we were going to do. Now on that trip, it was much more challenging as a doctor, because when you're underwater, you clearly can't make a telephone call to anybody to ask for any help. So you had to make all the decisions, and we had some more serious cases there of people who really damaged themselves. Had one junior officer who developed testicular cancer. We had to send home. And I think, although I, again, did lots of other stuff, I earned my doctoring money more on that trip than I had in the ship, really. I did that for 7 months, and that was great. And again, I had to do all the things to become a submariner. So you have to, you know, do the submarine escape tank. You have to go around and learn where all the valves are on a submarine. There's no passengers on submarines. You have to be part of the team because there's limited amount of people. But again, I think as the doctor, I integrated well, and I had this great job on board the submarine of being the video officer. So it was the commanding officer's last tour on a submarine. He'd been on submarines all his life, and he wanted it videoed. And so he had a little handy cam that I used. So everything that I could do that was not secret, I was there with the video as well. And one of the things I remember the most was as we surfaced, having been underwater for 2 months without coming up, I was the first person out of the conning tower to get the video as we came out. And I remember thinking, gosh, fresh air stinks. You should think you'd be going, lovely. And actually we came out. To be fair, it wasn't the fresh air. It was the fact that loads of dead things on the casing of the submarine had died and rotted. But I remember thinking it was going to be nice, and it wasn't.
And you went on to get your green beret.
Yes. And so after I did the submarine, I managed to convince the appointer to send me to a Royal Marines commando unit. So I went down to Commando Logistics Regiment, where I was with them for about a year and a half. And I did lots of things with them, but I went on my commando course and got my green beret and, you know, ate mud and climbed ropes and all that kind of sort of silly stuff. And then ended up in Norway as well, doing my Arctic warfare training. So in terms of the Navy having submarines, ships and Royal Marine Commandos, I got to see all bits of it during my general duties time, which was great.
So was it that moment when you spoke about earlier that you spoke to that Falklands veteran, was that the moment where you decided that mental health would be your focus? Or was that the real decision moment?
No, I think I had been interested. Actually, this goes back to before I joined the Navy properly. So I was at medical school, and originally when I thought about it without any great detail, I thought I'd wanted to be a surgeon because that sounded all very sort of doctory and choppy and saving lives and all that sort of stuff. And then I had spoken to a sort of mid-grade surgeon at some point about what's it like being a surgeon when I was a medical student. And he was really down on surgery. And he said, actually, you spend all day in theatre, you can't operate in theatre, you can't get out of theatre. And even when you come out, you then got to see the patients for the next day, and it's really busy, and I don't get home to see my family, and blah, 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 blah. I remember him thinking, I remember thinking, oh, that doesn't sound, you know, in terms of what my future is going to be like, that doesn't sound overly exciting. And then the next placement I did as a medical student was psychiatry. And although the psychiatrist I worked for, I have to say, was a bit strange, which is often said about psychiatrists, the patients were fascinating because you got to hear everybody's life story. And they told you, you know, things that you normally people just don't tell you because that's what you tell psychiatrists. And I remember thinking, this is really interesting. And then when I did more psychiatry in my last year at medical school, I that's when I think I said, well, you know, if I can do it, that's what I want to do.
What were the kind of things that people told you that you found fascinating?
Well, that they would tell you things about abuse they would suffered as a child, the fact that their wife thinks that they're fantastic, but they dislike themselves, and I'm generally a positive person, and when you hear people who are really unfortunately suffer with depression, their belief systems about the world are completely different to the ones that I had at the time, and you're thinking, this is amazing. I didn't realize that people thought like this, because you kind of, me and my friends, you just go about and you get on with your life. And I remember thinking that these poor people trapped in this awful environment, if you can do something to make them better, that's important, because I really wanted to make a difference in my life. And I think people who don't know a lot about psychiatry assume that you do a lot of listening, but you don't necessarily get people better. And the good news I can sure you and listeners is that people do get better, and it was a great privilege, and it still remains a great privilege to try and help them get back to having a decent life.
Tell me about your experience on HMS Nottingham. What happened?
So HMS Nottingham was a Type 42 destroyer, and so I at that time it ended up in 2002 hitting a rock off the coast of Australia, Lord Howe Island actually. And at that time, I was doing my psychiatry training. I developed a real interest in psychological trauma, which is not surprising, being in the military. And I remember I'd just given a presentation at the Emergency Planning Society conference, which was in Bournemouth. And I was driving home, having given this presentation about what the military does for trauma and the like. And I got a phone call saying, pack your bags, you need to get to Heathrow. This ship's hit this rock, and you're going to lead a team out there to try and provide some psychological support. And back then I thought, great, that sounds fantastic. So I went to, there were four of us who went out. And HMS Nottingham basically had this really bad incident where it nearly sunk. And at the time, the Navy were using what is now called TRIM, Trauma Risk Management, which was this peer support system that was developed in the Royal Marines in the late 1990s. And so basically, because the ship had been badly damaged, Fleet Command wanted psychological support to be provided. And so I went out with two warrant officers. One of them was Navy, one of them was Marines, and a Marine sergeant. And those three other people were all trimmed, they were all trained in how to do this psychological peer support. So I was going out to kind of lead that. And so we went out, and then we made contact with the ship by radio. It was sort of off the coast, damaged, listing to one side. And when we got out to actually meet the ship's company, they'd come on board. They'd come onto the island, including the doctor. And I was a doctor, so I met the ship's doctor. And they said, "So why are you here?" And my colleagues, the Navy and Marine chaps, said, "Oh, we're the specialists." Because in their mind, they were here to be the psychological specialists. The people from HMS Nottingham thought we were salvage specialists. And so they were really quite excited to have salvage specialists here. And when they found out that we were psychological specialists, they were like, "Oh, we don't want anything to do with this." But we managed to coax them, and we ended up, and we did loads of really good supportive work. And I ended up supporting some of the more senior officers and the doctor generally. And so it was a really good experience. And then what we were able to do is the ship had, HMS Nottingham, had to get towed backwards to Australia because the front was so badly damaged. And they had to decide who was going to stay on board for that tow bit and who needed to go back onto Australia. So we were able to say, look, we've seen lots of people. These people here, they're good to go. They can stay on board the ship. These ones, they're a bit more fragile. You should probably send them back to Australia at the time to then get them home. And so I think we were able to make a good impression.
What kind of support did they need, Neil?
So mostly what they needed is we are able to identify people who were a bit distressed. And what that basically means is that their seniors need to give them a bit more support. It means that they need not to be put under a lot of pressure. So as a general rule, after psychological trauma, the two best strategies for supporting people are to increase their general support, so not psychological support, but general support, and to temporarily decrease the pressure that they experience. So hence not keeping them on board the ship while it's being towed backwards. So what you do, the way then that TRIM works is you do two chats with people. You do one a few days after the event and another one about a month later. And then what you are hoping to see is that people recover, and most people exposed to trauma do recover. But the ones who don't recover, you then get referred on to speak to someone like me, a psychological health professional. So the first month or so is very much about not making it psychological. It's making the team work and the team be supportive, keeping an eye on people. Although we did have one chap who developed mutism. So basically he lost his voice. He couldn't speak. And he got, it was very bizarre. It was a psychological mutism. So it wasn't a physical thing. And luckily he got better. So I had one psychiatric patient to deal with. But mostly they were sailors who had been involved in a difficult incident. And actually most of them did okay.
And that reaction that you talked about when they realised you were there, you were specialist, psychological specialist, did you get that a lot in your career? It's a bit of a reputation that the military's had in the past is to not necessarily want to be very open about talking about and seeking psychological help. Just wondering if you found that was a sort of hurdle you had to get over.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say that when you say, hi, I'm you know, Surgeon Commander Greenberg, I'm the psychiatrist, everyone goes, great, the psychiatrist is here. Oh, my gosh, the psychiatrist is here. Really busy, sir. I've just got to disappear. I remembered I've got something really important to do. But I think that shifted over time. And one of the great things about TRIM, about the peer support system, is what the guys and girls who do TRIM are able to do is to say, listen, I can talk to you because I'm just like you. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm a chef or a sailor or a marine. And that if someone's having a tough time, they can say, listen, I know this bloke, Neil. He's okay, actually. Come and have a chat with him. And so that the TRIM practitioners effectively become the eyes and ears of the mental health specialists. So I think one of the things that I found is that because I've got my, you know, commando badge or dolphin or some, you know, something to say that I'm like you, people were comfortable enough to speak to me, but it really helped having the introduction from a sort of TRIM practitioner who was non-medical. And I also think that over time that the stigma about mental health has definitely shifted. It hasn't gone away, but it's definitely got better over the years.
And at what point did you realise or decide that you wanted to take this onto a much bigger scale and become who you have become since? I mean, how did you go from wanting to treat individuals and being part of the team to taking it on to a much higher level?
Well, as I went through my psychiatric training whilst in the Navy, one of the things that I was really interested in is what's the evidence, you know, what works and what doesn't work, including TRIM, including this peer support system. So I got involved in interested in looking at the science behind the way that psychiatry works. And because I was the psychiatrist who was in the military who was interested in it, I ended up doing an academic job and then slowly developed my academic sort of potential and experience, and I ended up becoming the defense professor of mental health because I was the person who was most interested, and I published papers and, you know, did a doctorate and that sort of thing. So I guess luckily for me, I didn't have competition. You know, none of the other psychiatrists wanted to go down that route, so that was a route that was open to me, and that's what I did. And I think one of the things that the job at the moment allows me to do, and I'm still with King's College London, is when someone says, well, that's interesting, I wonder if that would work, we can take that in a scientific sense and actually work out if it does, because not all psychological interventions do make a difference. Some of them don't work at all, and some of them have a potential to cause harm. And so I think the science behind psychological and psychiatric treatments is really important, because we want to do the right thing. We want to help patients and not harm them.
And what drew you to want to research the effect on mental health of troops deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, we'd had lots of data for a long time on what happens after after wars and after deployments. You know, does war affect you? But really, from an occupational point of view, the most important time we need service personnel to be psychologically fit is when they're at war, when they're doing their job. And so I led a small team. We went out to Iraq for the first time in 2009 to look at troops who were doing their duty in a war zone, because that's a bit about their mental health. We don't want them to be injured. But importantly for the military, it's about how do we optimize performance. So in the military, it's not just about we want to save people's mental health, which of course you do, but you really want people to do their job well. And that means they need to be psychologically healthy. There's very good evidence that people who have poor mental health perform poorly. And therefore, we had to gather data whilst they were doing the doing. So we had to go out to forward operating bases and patrol bases and gather data to find out what the mental health was at the time, because that then allows the operational commanders to know how they should deploy their troops and what they do with them.
And do you think that research has a legacy for today's servicemen and women?
Oh, definitely. The OMNI, as it was called, the Operational Mental Health Needs Evaluation, that process is still used. So absolutely, I think it does. And what it also allows a bit to do, I think the military's still got more work to do on this, is to say, if we've had an operational deployment and we've had lots of psychological distress or casualties, then we need to plan for the future that actually we're going to have patients who are going to come our way. And of course, the military will see those patients, but so will the NHS, because when people leave the services and become veterans, the NHS picks up their care. So in theory, what I'd like to see more of is using the data we gather on people who are deployed operationally to then inform what services will be needed later on to unfortunately treat those who become unwell.
And when you think back to listening to that person speaking on the radio about their time in the Navy, their time on the QE2, what were your expectations of your career? Can you think back and see and compare what you thought your career would be like then and how it's actually panned out?
I don't think I had any idea at all. And I think my attitude at the time, and to some degree a bit now, is always like, I'll just go and take the first step and see what happens. You know, if it's a good, my belief in life is that you can't know where the river's going to end up. But if you jump on a little boat and it looks like it's going in a good direction, well, that's okay, because there's another little boat over there and maybe I can jump on that one in a bit. I don't want to be standing on the side of the river looking at all the boats go by.
And what's been your most challenging moment?
Gosh, I think probably combination of military and personal life is when I've got twin girls who are beautiful, but when they and lovely and clever and fantastic, but when they were born, one of them had a bit of a health problem, which is fine now. And it was that kind of, I want to do my job, but at the same time, I've got my family here. And so that was the first time I had that dilemma, and it's all worked out, but I dealt with that at the time. But that was a challenge back then when they were born.
And what about your most memorable moments?
Most memorable moments? Oh, gosh, there's loads of them. I think probably going back to my early career, sitting on the bridge wing in HMS Monmouth, and we're in the Pacific, and we've been at sea for sort of, you know, 4 or 5 months. I'm probably sipping a tin of special vat cider. I didn't sip too many of them, but I did. Looking at a sunset, thinking, this is just amazing. You know, I'm being paid to sit here. And we were just off the coast of Galapagos. We never went to Galapagos, although I did get bitten by a big beetle thing, which I'm sure came from there. I remember sitting there thinking, yeah, this is pretty amazing. But there's been loads of great times.
And what's really interesting talking to you is that you remember things in such detail, like it happened yesterday.
Yeah, my wife says that too about me. Sure, I've also forgotten lots of things as well, but I do have plenty of rich moments in my life that I do recall. And, you know, luckily, the vast majority are very positive thoughts, which is good for me, I guess.
And that moment, the moment that made you, what kind of person do you think it has made you?
I think it's made me someone who is able to help other people, which is something I wanted to do. It's led me to not just look at people's health generally, but also to look at how people perform. So I'm really interested now in occupational mental health. I'm the president-elect of the Society of Occupational Medicine. I'll be the first psychiatrist to lead that ever. And it's been around for 90 years. And my interest now is about not just keeping people well, but how does their mental health affect and get affected by their employment? And I'm a great believer that actually for many of us, employment is a really good thing. And what we really need are people who are psychologically healthy so they can do their job well. But also their employers should be equally as interested in their mental health. So it's led me to this nice position of looking at mental health and employment, which is fascinating. I always love systems. You know, if you have a patient and they're not doing well and they're at work, you sometimes can't treat that patient as an individual. You can give them as much therapy or medication, but if they're having a harassing boss or they're finding work too difficult, you've got to do something about their work, because the treatment itself won't make the difference. And so that's where I think I'm lucky to be able to influence that. And I get to sit on lots of things with, you know, executives and government panels and all that stuff. So hopefully I'm making a little bit of difference being a lot of places.
And you sound like you love it.
Yeah, I think I'm very lucky, although I'm also a believer in you make your own luck.
Plenty more boats to jump on. Professor Neil Greenberg, great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.